Good evening, ladies and gentlemen, members and guests. It's wonderful to see a large group here this evening. I'd like to welcome you all to tonight's program, which is called Negotiating with Iran. Joining us is Ambassador John Limbert, who is currently a Distinguished Professor of International Affairs at the U.S. Naval Academy. My name is Dennis Bonney. I'm a trustee of the Council, and I'm very honored to be your moderator this evening. I'd also like to acknowledge Books, Inc., who are co-sponsoring tonight's program, and as you've probably seen, there's a pile of books there, which you're welcome to purchase after the talk. And I've had the opportunity to read most of it, and it's absolutely fascinating. For those of you who may be new to our organization, the World Affairs Council of Northern California provides a forum where policymakers, heads of state, business executives, philanthropists, academics, civic leaders, and an attentive public engage in issues of international importance. Please consult our website for more information about us. When you are unable to attend a program, you can still stay informed by accessing the Council's podcasts and streaming radio and video online. We are multimedia. If you would like to re-listen to this evening's remarks, I'd encourage you to make use of this great collection. And Council and programs can also be heard on the weekly one-hour radio show, It's Your World, which airs every Monday evening at 8 p.m., so you have time to do it this evening, on National Public Radio, KQED 88.5 FM. Tonight's program will not be repeated tonight, but it will be repeated another day, and it's being recorded with the assistance of our able audio engineer, Paul Lancour. Lastly, I'd encourage you all to make use of the blue question cards, which were on your seats. I hope you've taken them off your seats. Please hand them to Council staff members with questions you would like to be addressed to our speaker. Audience questions will be posed to Ambassador Limbert during the second half of our program. And now, before we begin, please take a moment to turn off all cell phones and any other noise-making devices. And while you do that, I'd like to say a few words about future programs. On Thursday, November 19th, the Council's Young Professional International Forum will host an Arabic language reception with the Consul General of Egypt, Dr. Hesham Al-Nakib. He will address the gathering in Arabic and discuss Egyptian-U.S. relations under the new Obama administration. This talk will be followed by a unique opportunity to savor Arabic food and listen to live Arabic music. This event will take place here at the Council Auditorium at 6:30 on that date. Now, it's my distinct honor. I don't know whether I told you who I am. I'm Dennis Bonney, a trustee of the World Affairs Council. Maybe I'm repeating myself. It's my distinct honor to introduce tonight's speaker. Dr. John W. Limbert was appointed Distinguished Professor of International Affairs at the U.S. Naval Academy in August 2006 after a 33-year career with the United States Foreign Service. He was President of the American Foreign Service Association from 2003 to 2005, and he was Ambassador to the country of Mauritania from the year 2000 to 2003. He also served in Algeria, Djibouti, Iran, Saudi Arabia, and the United Arab Emirates. He holds the Department of State's highest award, the Distinguished Service Award, and the Award for Valor, which he received in 1981 after 14 months as a hostage in Iran, much of that in isolation. Not incidentally, this month is the 30th anniversary of the seizure of the U.S. Embassy, which took place on November 4th, 1979. Dr. Limbert has a PhD from Harvard University in History and Middle East Studies, and he's taught in Iranian high schools as a Peace Scholar, a Peace Corps member, excuse me, and also as a professor at the University of Shiraz. He speaks Farsi, French, and Arabic. He's written numerous articles on Middle East subjects and has authored Iran at War with History and Shiraz in the Age of Hafiz. And we were delighted to learn last week that Ambassador Limit has been appointed Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Iran in the Bureau of Near Eastern Affairs at the Department of State. And I'd like to offer our congratulations on this role. And especially our thanks for him keeping his engagement with the World Affairs Council here in San Francisco. Now, here to discuss his latest work is Ambassador Limbert. The latest work is his book, wonderful book, Negotiating with Iran, Wrestling the Ghosts of History. Ladies and gentlemen, please join me in welcoming Ambassador John Limbert.
Thank you, Dr. Well, thank you very much, Dennis, for that very kind introduction, and thank you to the World Affairs Council and to all of you for coming out this evening. I was listening to a report this morning on National Public Radio, and it said that in her book tour, Sarah Palin was not coming to San Francisco. Now, despite what you may, rumors to the contrary, she and I have not divided up the country between us in terms of promoting our respective books. The story of this particular book began 30 years ago, almost to the day. Dennis referred to the 30 years since the seizure of the embassy. And that story begins with a failure of negotiation, and a very personal failure of negotiation. Because on that day, what happened to me was this. About 12 days before, someone decided that it would be a good idea if the deposed Shah of Iran was admitted to the United States for medical treatment. That was about the 20th of October, 1979. On the 4th of November, 1979, we at the U.S. Embassy, and I was serving at the U.S. Embassy at the time, faced a crowd of maybe 500 or 600 very unhappy young Iranians who stormed the embassy compound, broke into the building, and were banging on a steel door on the second floor of the chancery, the office building, behind which about 150 American and Iranian employees of the embassy had taken shelter. There was no help to be had from the host government, which normally is responsible for the security of diplomats. Washington was far away. It was 3 a.m. on a Sunday in Washington. And so whatever was going to be done, we had to do. To give you an example of the state of the host country, which was under something then called the Provisional Government of Iran, when we called the foreign ministry explaining the situation and saying they needed to get some help very quickly before the situation deteriorated, the response, and I was making this phone call as one of the Persian speakers in the embassy, the response from the person on the other end of the line was, "Oh, thank you for calling. We're very glad to hear. And those passports we sent over for visas, are they ready yet?" (Laughter) having heard that, I knew we were in trouble. So I made what was probably one of the worst decisions of my Foreign Service career, which was to go outside the steel door. No one pushed me out. It just seemed it wasn't a good idea, but it was no one had a better one. So I went outside the steel door to talk, negotiate, persuade, whatever word you want to use, to either convince these young people to leave or at least to buy some time so that somewhere someone with a cooler head might prevail and get them out. Well, my negotiation skills that day didn't work very well. The results were, as you know, that I and 50-some of my colleagues spent the next 444 days in Mark Bowden's wonderful phrase as guests of the Ayatollah. This was certainly a monumental personal breakdown of negotiations, a personal failure. And I've, since that day, I've looked back at those events and asked myself, what were the flaws in my negotiating technique? What might I have done better given the situation that day? To this day, I really don't have a good answer, except to make this observation that if you're at the table in a high-stakes game and in your hand you hold a pair of twos, you had better either be a damn good bluffer or you shouldn't be at that table at all. And figuratively, we should not have been at the table that day. Our hand was weak, and the students who attacked the embassy knew it well. That's the beginning. Now, at my publisher's request, I'm not going to read from the book. As my publisher said, if you did that, who would buy it? I'm not quite sure how to take that, but I will not. But let me make a couple of observations about the book. One is the title. I deliberately call it Negotiating with Iran. I do not call it Negotiating with the Islamic Republic of Iran. I do not call it Negotiating with Mr. Ahmadinejad. Because for me, the question is not should we or shouldn't we, although I have my own views about that, which I'm happy to share at great length. But the question is, when we eventually move to end this 30-year estrangement between our countries, how can we best deal with our Iranian counterpart? Whoever he is, or she, whoever he or she is, and whatever government that counterpart represents. Because I'm sure most of you know, and historians know, and people familiar with Iran know, that there is much, much more to Iran, and much, much more to negotiating with Iranians than the sometimes absurdities of Mr. Ahmadinejad and the nastiness and the brutality of the current system. There is a lot more there. and you have to know a lot more. Now, by training and by background, I'm a historian, and there's a lot of history in the book. So those of you who don't like history, I'd warn you away from the book. But my real interest and research is the medieval period, 14th century Shiraz. That was a time when Iranians produced not only masterpieces of their own tradition in poetry, in medicine, in miniatures, in calligraphy, but world-class masterpieces. I mean, the lyrics of Hafez are some of the greatest produced anywhere. It was a period of great cultural flowering in which a highly creative people and highly intellectual people were ruled by a group of bigots, thugs, and hypocrites. Now, you might say there's a certain resemblance to our own time, but I'll leave that for you, for the conclusion for you. But my historical bias comes through in the subtitle of the book, Wrestling the Ghosts of History, because history is there, and I'm going to talk a little bit more about what one does, how you deal with a very long and difficult history. I've looked at four case studies of negotiation with Iran. Two from before 1979, before the Islamic Republic was ever established. One was the Azerbaijan crisis of 1945-47. The other was the oil nationalization crisis of 1951-53. And then two afterwards, one being the embassy takeover 79-81, and then the crisis involving the American hostages and other Western hostages held in Lebanon, with a little, I couldn't resist, a little side trip into Iran-Contra. Since I teach at the Naval Academy, of course, it's a very relevant piece of history up there. And I pose the question, what can we learn from these cases, the successes and the failures that we found in these four historical cases, and what is it in these cases that could help an American negotiator, because these books are put together by the U.S. Institute of Peace for an American negotiator, and the U.S. Institute of Peace has a series on cross-cultural negotiation. So you can find a book about negotiating with China, negotiating with Korea, negotiating with France, with the Arabs, with the Israelis, and so forth. They are even putting together a book now about negotiating with Americans. And I haven't seen the book, but I'm told it's not always very pretty, some of the things that are in there. So the question is, from these historical cases, what can we learn? What will help an American negotiator dealing with his or her Iranian counterparts, whoever they are? And it's whether the issue is whether it's a commercial issue, whether it's a nuclear program, whether it's terrorism, Afghanistan, or an imprisoned American citizen. And I take from these historical cases 14 suggestions. Now, some clever people have called these Limbert's 14 points, or some people have said Limbert's 14-step program. But they are simply ideas, things that worked, things that didn't work, perhaps lessons to be learned. And they're not terribly profound, such as be sure you're talking to the right people, or use intermediaries with care. People who have experience with negotiation in general, or with Iran in particular, I think these are pretty obvious points. However, I will make one very important disclaimer. This 14-step program comes with no guarantees. You may do all the right things and still make no progress. Why is that? Because 30 years of suspicion, hostility, and estrangement have created a situation where breaking out of what's called, what I call a downward spiral in our relation, breaking the impasse, has become very difficult to do. Now, until very recently, I was teaching a course at the U.S. Naval Academy just on U.S.-Iranian relations. And my students, most of whom were born about 1989, you know how that makes me feel, very quickly get to the heart of the matter and said, you know, the situation today doesn't make any sense. Why is it the way it is? Why are relations so bad, and why can't we break out of it? And I have to go back and say, look, the hostility, the suspicion, it is extremely deep on both sides. For 30 years, we have been trading insults, we have been trading threats, we have been calling each other names, we have been thumping our chests. And you know, if you thump your chest for 30 years, you get a sore chest. You don't get much else coming out of it. And this suspicion and hostility is mutual. I mean, let's look on the Iranian side. It's typified for me in a famous statement of Khomeini that keeps coming back in Iranian political discourse. Once he was asked about negotiations with the United States, he said, what's your view of negotiating with the United States? And his response was, look, what does the wolf have to negotiate with the sheep? In other words, historically, we are the sheep, they are the wolf, they have no interest in reaching some mutual agreement with us. Their only interest is to eat us or to humiliate us. And the view on the American side, I must say, is not that different. Because there is a prevailing view that one could never have successful negotiations with leaders who do and say what the current leaders of Iran do and say, because they writ large, are too fanatical, too xenophobic, too suspicious to deal with. So you could turn Khomeini's statement around and say, what does the rational have to negotiate with the crazy? Oh, you can see how difficult this impasse is to break. And the question is, how do you get out of it? That's some of what I look at in my book. How in the past did people get into the impasse, and was it possible to get out of it, or at least how do we avoid some of the traps that put us in it or buried us deeper? And I take as my starting point the advice of the wonderful 13th century Iranian poet Saadi. And Saadi says, whomever you see in the robe of an ascetic, consider him an ascetic and a man of virtue. In other words, don't make assumptions that this person is evil, a hypocrite, and a liar until you know differently. In other words, if he's dressed like an ascetic, until you know differently, consider him an ascetic. Now, what's he talking about? He's talking about preconceptions. And what he's warning us off of, he's warning us against the negative preconception, where we go into a negotiation assuming the faults of the other side. Now, it was interesting to me, and this was long before the idea of rejoining the government came up, that 5 or 6 days after his inauguration, President Obama gave this interview, famous interview, to Al Arabiya television. And he didn't talk about Iran very much. He talked mostly about Arab and Arab-Israeli issues. But he talked about the need to put aside negative preconceptions, how damaging these were. Now, did President Obama know Saadi? Well, it may be coincidence, but 3 months later, when he addressed the Iranian people on the occasion of Nowruz, the Persian New Year, he did quote from Saadi, another, not the same one, but I suppose it may be. I mean, it's interesting to me to see that that influence. That certainly President Obama understands well how damaging these negative preconceptions can be. So not only do we have to watch for the assumption about the other side, but we have to deal simultaneously with two realities, which in a sense are a paradox. We need to have realistic expectations, and at the same time, we need to have high expectations. We have to be patient, we have to be demanding, and we need to be both at the same time. Let me talk about being patient or realistic. And in this area, I quote one of my Foreign Service colleagues, Ambassador Ryan Crocker, who recently retired as ambassador to Iraq. He was talking about Iraq, but he said, in Iraq, remember, everything takes longer than you think, everything is harder than you think, and somewhere, somehow, whatever you do, someone's going to come along and screw it up. Well, if that's true about Iraq, it is doubly true for Iran. And history has shown it. When we have made progress or seen to be making progress, back in 1979, there was the Javits Resolution. Back in 1979, there was the decision to admit the Shah. More recently, there was the Axis of Evil speech. Then, more recently than that, there was the Fishy election. And then there, before that, there was Ahmadinejad's statements about the Holocaust and the denial of the Holocaust. All of these things, as though there was some either diabolical coincidence at work, or someone consciously is actually, in Ambassador Crocker's words, trying to screw it up. And in that situation, patience is everything. That you have to get beyond the immediate difficulty and not let these things derail what you want to do, so that progress may be measured in very small things, very symbolic things, something not said, something omitted, a gesture, a change of tone, whatever it is. These can represent progress, and you have to see them for what they are. Now let me talk a bit on the demanding side. On the demanding side, I think you have to have pretty good expectations. Because if we go into an encounter with Iran, assuming that they, the other side, are simply too stubborn, too irrational, too unreasonable, then we will fail. Assume the worst about the other side, and in any negotiation, it becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. However, if you assume that success, modestly defined, as I suggested, is possible, you may be pleasantly surprised by what you actually can achieve. Let me thank you all for your attention. I want to give special thanks tonight to my wife, who is here, who for the last 43 years has given me many, many lessons in negotiation. So with that, I will end and look forward to your questions. Thank you. I'll take them from here.
All right. Thank you. Thank you very much, Ambassador Limford. We have a large number of questions. Talking of change of tone, you just talked about that in the final few remarks. This questioner says, recently Ayatollah Montazeri, who was close to Khomeini, said that the taking of American hostages has been a mistake. How significant is this admission?
I have a special feeling for the gentleman. I actually went and called on him about a month before the embassy was taken. I listened to him at a Friday sermon about a week before the embassy was taken, and then he came to visit us at the embassy. I think it was around Christmas of 79. But he's been in opposition really since 1989 or 88, and he has been quite outspoken. This statement from Ayatollah Montazeri is not a surprise to me. What was interesting to me is to see that many of those then young people, now not so young people, people in their 50s now, which I guess is young for me, now are saying something of the same thing. They're very close to saying that it was a mistake. They're not quite there yet in public, but many of them are almost there. And maybe many of them have implicitly said this because some at least have joined the reformist opposition and spoke about the rule of law and civil society and all these nice things which they had helped to destroy 20 years earlier. And, I mean, things come full circle. The climate of lawlessness that they created in 1979 has now come back to haunt them. And some of them have become victims. Now this, I suppose, the old cliche, what's the old cliche? Revolution eats its own children. Well, here you certainly have an example And I noticed that in the recent show trial in Iran, one of the people on trial was the esteemed Mr. Mirdamadi, who was in his youth one of our hosts and quite a firebrand in his own time. And now he's talking about the need for reform and the need for the rule of law and so forth. So yes, they're getting there. In terms of Ayatollah Montazeri, it doesn't surprise me. I don't think he was ever comfortable with what happened. But it's interesting to see the gradual and glacial change in attitude.
Here's another question about that terrible time. Before you were taken hostage in Iran, how did you visualize the outcome of the Iranian Revolution? Did you think Iran would turn into a democracy, or did you anticipate that the country would turn into a theocracy?
I hoped the former, and I suppose I deluded myself like a lot of friends of Iran did. I certainly hoped that the revolution would bring something better for Iran than the previous dictatorship. And at the beginning, it appeared that it might be possible. You know, if you looked at the people who at least were the office holders in the first months after the revolution, these were the heirs of Mossadegh, followers of Mossadegh, and the old National Front. And these were ministers, these were governors, these were heads of universities. And there was also this period of the Thousand Flowers. I mean, there were newspapers, hundreds of newspapers, left, right, center, from ethnic groups. There were debates every day. It was as though the lid had gone off this pressure cooker, and all this creativity, all this energy was there. By the summer of 79, that's when I actually arrived in Tehran to start work at the embassy, the signs were not good. And it was clear that the authoritarian trend, the trend that was intolerant of opposition, the trend that was going to impose the harshest kind of rules, was gaining control. Of course, when we admitted the Shah, one of the things we did, ironically, was to deal the death blow to any chance that the Islamic Revolution would end up with something better for our Iranian friends.
There's a question about the current situation. Israel seems to want to bypass negotiations in favor of military action. Will the U.S. be able to resist that approach? And there's another question that asks what you see as the positive or negative results from such intervention.
Let me try. The first, I have no idea. The second, I can't see anything but negatives coming from another armed conflict in the region, just because the outcome of such things are impossible to predict. You know, I went to Iraq in 2003 with the first team that was supposed to help in the reconstruction. And I was told, your mission is 60 days in and out. That was the planning. Well, because it was 60 days, of course, there was no planning. Because why do you need planning if you're only there for 60 days? For 60 days, and essentially they took me out of my post where I was, and said, "Go there. You'll be back in 60 days, because by that time there will be an interim Iraqi authority, and we won't need your groups, the Iraqis won't need the advisors, and then we can simply set up an embassy to deal state to state. Well, obviously, 8 years later, that was 2003, so 6 years later, we're still there. So I don't see much, it's hard to see anything good coming out of another armed conflict in that area. And of course, who are the victims? The victims will be the ordinary citizens, frankly, on both sides.
Kind of a follow-up to that, are there any sanctions you can think of that can be imposed on Iran to rein in its nuclear program that would pressure the leaders but not the Iranian people too much? This is making a distinction between sanctions that affect the government and sanctions that affect every individual citizen.
Well, I suppose one could find them, but our record on it isn't very good. I recently listened to an Iraqi come. He came to the Naval Academy, and he had been in opposition. He was an Iraqi officer who was from a Shia family, had been in opposition since 91, had been in and out of prison, had fled to Iran, and his comment was that the sanctions against Iraq resulted in the death of about 300,000 people from either disease or malnutrition. More than that, what affected him, and I remember this, he said it was the poverty and the fact that Iraqi women and girls were being bought and sold in cafes in Amman for $3. And I was there and I could not do anything about it. And what could be worse than that for an individual? So I'm cautious about sanctions just because the record is so uneven. Now, having said that, one thing in my experience that this Iranian government does not like is being treated as a pariah and being treated like North Korea or Libya or Sudan bothers it a lot. Not necessarily in a material sense, but in a psychological sense. And that it is a blow to self-esteem. So in that sense, yes. And it's not by accident that in 2003, you know this story, the Iranians proposed essentially a grand bargain. They sent a proposal through the Swiss embassy in Tehran to negotiate over a whole range of issues between us. And at the head of that list of issues were the sanctions. So clearly the sanctions bother them, but I'm not sure if they. I'm not so sure, so certain they bother them in an economic way or in a more psychological way.
If I can presume to mention again what you mentioned, that your wife is here, who is Iranian, I think, and this question I ask if you could speak to the warmth and welcoming nature of a large percentage of Iranians. distinguish the people from their government.
We always in the Foreign Service, this is sort of the trick when you're dealing with a country where relations are thoroughly bad, and we often do this, and you have to make a public speech You usually talk about the wonderful people-to-people relations that exist without ever mentioning the government. I mean, I served in Sudan, and relations were just awful. So I had good practice in talking in of simply avoiding the subject, but talking about the wonderful relations that existed between our two peoples. But in the Iranian case, it's true. I mean, my roots there go back a long way, probably 45, 46 years, as a teacher, as a researcher, as a university professor, but probably most of all as a family member, as a husband, a son-in-law, a brother-in-law, and so forth. And I suppose that's why the hostage taking, the captivity, came as such a collective shock. Because in my experience, Iranians are like, they're like the rest of us. They will do all kinds of things, sort of good, bad, and indifferent. But in my experience, what Iranians would never do would be to mistreat a guest, and a guest for whom they were, whose safety they were responsible. To me, that was a complete aberration, and went against everything else that I have seen. People who go now to Iran, and tourists continue to go, although in smaller numbers, seem to be amazed by the warm welcome that they receive. I recommend to you a beautiful film called BAM 6.6. Any of you familiar with this? Made about the earthquake. Absolutely beautiful. In terms of the human warmth that exists, and how in this particular case some American victims of the earthquake benefited from that.
Thank you. This is asking you to bore in a little bit more on that same subject. How would you negotiate the freedom of the three U.S. Berkeley students if they are being, who are guests of Iran?
With patience. No, as a matter of fact, I think the first day I was in my job, the parents of the three students came in to the Department of State and had a meeting with Secretary Clinton. So this is something, obviously it's difficult. One thing you can do is realize that Iran, not unlike us, Iranians not unlike us, have to deal with their own domestic politics. And there are competing groups, competing factions. There is a certain amount of posturing going on. No one wants other people to get credit for something, which makes a very simple decision sometimes very complicated. I have no doubt that the Iranians realized these were hikers who strayed over a border area. You know, I lived in that area of western Iran for a couple of years, and I know that area, and there are no markers along the borders, and the language is the same, the terrain is the same. There's no way of telling which side you're on. I think the Iranians have figured that out, but their own politics, I think, make it much, much harder. The other thing is keep these issues humanitarian. That people understand this. That a mother is concerned, a brother is concerned, a family is concerned about the person. The other thing you can do is, in negotiation term, they call this set out the yesable proposition. That is, you say, all right, can you arrange, can we get the Swiss consular officer in Tehran to visit these people, as is the case under international agreements. In fact, that has happened. Can we get these people, can we get letters exchanged from these people, because one of her, his family members, his uncle, is not well and is very concerned. So can we get a letter to these people? These are things that the other, in a situation like this, the other side can say yes to without in seeming to give away the whole case. But I have no doubt that these people will be released. What I can't say is when. But I hope it will be very soon.
Thank you. How will China's growing influence in the region, the whole Middle East region, affect U.S.-Iranian relations, in your opinion? You've been at the job about how 1 week, is it?
Yes. I have no idea
about that.
I was afraid someone would ask a question like that. I mean, Iran will obviously pursue its own foreign policy and its own interest. Traditionally, what Iran has had to do is to walk a space between competing larger powers that had ambitions. Many of you, I'm sure, have heard of the Great Game, in which Iran was caught between competing interests of Tsarist Russia and Imperial Britain. Later on, it was between the Soviet Union and Britain. Then it was between the Soviet Union and the United States. And in a situation like that, you look for others. You look to balance the two. You look for space that you can maneuver in. And you look for others. But it has led Iran in this kind of maneuvering into some uncomfortable places, such as, for example, when the Chinese have had difficulties with their own ethnic minorities, particularly the Muslim minorities. You know, I once asked a Chinese colleague of mine, I said, do you have a Muslim community in your country? And he said, yes, we do, but it's very, very small. And he said, I said, well, how large? He said, well, it's only 60 million. this kind of political balancing act, if you like, or searching for space, has put the Iranians occasionally into difficulty, where they have had, for example, to turn the other way when their fellow Muslims were being killed in Western China or in Chechnya or in former Yugoslavia.
So, talking of China's Muslim population, I think that China says that they have the second largest Muslim population of any country in the world after Indonesia. In sheer numbers. Next question. Here's it's a rather long question, but I'll try to abbreviate it a bit. In the last 10 to 15 years, have the relations between the U.S. and Iran improved on occasions, and showed promise? If so, how in the course of events did they regress? Why did they regress? And how do you account for the positive and negative swings? And who is to blame?
Between the U.S. and Iran.
Yeah, and yes, individuals,
okay.
I suppose, if you wish.
Okay. One thing I would not want to get into is the who is to blame. I find that a pretty futile exercise, because you end up finger pointing. and you say, well, it's all your fault. And if only you would change, everything would be great. Anyone who's ever raised teenagers or has ever had any kind of a relationship will know how ineffective that is. Let me cite one of my favorite journalists, who is Barbara Slavin, who writes for the Washington Times, has a very good book called Bitter Friends, Bosom Enemies. She describes the U.S.-Iranian relationship, and she says that relationship is like two teenagers maneuvering over who is going to invite whom to the prom. And each is afraid of rejection. And so when one moves forward, the other moves back. And that has been the problem. At the end of the Clinton administration, the U.S. made what I think was a very good offer to the Iranians for negotiations with no preconditions. Secretary Albright called it a roadmap to better relations. And maybe because of President Khatami's domestic problems, or maybe for other reasons that we don't know, the Iranians turned it down. In 2003, I mentioned this grand bargain that the Iranians proposed. The Bush administration at the time never responded to it. This, unfortunately, has been the history. When one side comes forward, the other steps back. And one reason, I think, is this long residue or deep residue of suspicion on both sides, so that if the other side comes forward, or one side comes forward, what does the other side immediately think? Ah, they must be up to something. There has to be a trick. Go back to the wolf and the sheep. You know, that wolf is not interested in negotiating with us. That wolf wants to eat us. And this is just the latest trick in a long history of humiliation. And that seems to have been the pattern. Otherwise, how do you explain it? I mean, as I said, my students very quickly look at this relationship and say, this doesn't make any sense. I mean, we and the Chinese broke relations in 1949. 23 years later, Nixon was visiting China, despite the fact that we had fought a war in the meantime. Why has this particular relationship been so difficult, and this particular impasse been so difficult to break?
Well, here's a questioner who raises one possible reason. Says, is there a reason why President Ahmadinejad denies the Holocaust ever happened? You mentioned that in your speech. Doesn't that slow down the prospect for peace talks?
Of course it does. Actually, I just saw a very interesting posting on a website called Gulf 2000. I don't know if some of you are familiar with this. This is a very good like a chat group on Persian Gulf affairs, but it's about 90% about Iran, in which one scholar talks about the origin of some of Ahmadinejad's views and traces it to someone I had not heard of called Ahmad Fardid, who was apparently an Iranian political thinker in the early 20th century, who took a lot of his ideas from fascist Europe. But the interesting thing for me was two things. One was that Ahmadinejad's rhetoric became a campaign issue during the recent presidential contest, in which his opponents were criticizing him, saying, your rhetoric and your threatening statements are not helping the interests of our country, because you are going to get us into a war that we don't need and that we cannot win and that will destroy us. The other interesting facet of this whole argument is that at the same time that he was making these statements, Iranian official TV, the state-run TV, was running a soap opera, or not a soap opera, but like a mini-series called Zero Degree Turn. And it was based on actually some real incidents of an Iranian vice consul in Paris during World War II who issued passports to Jews, to European Jews, and was able to rescue them. And this story came out on sort of official Iranian TV at the same time the president of this country was making these statements. Now, if there was no Holocaust, what was he rescuing them from? So it's contradictory, but I think some of his statements have not been taken well by his own countrymen, and not just opposition figures, but people within the Islamic Republic.
Thank you. We have time for only one more question, and the last question really has to do with your new job at the State Department. What's the goal of negotiations with Iran? Is it nuclear weapons? Is that realistic? If not, what is the goal? What are your expectations? Maybe you have to get to that next week, but if you have any thoughts, please let us know.
Good. I asked myself, my first day on the job, I was asking myself that question. My expectations are fairly low for this, or modest, I guess. I come back to this fact. 30 years of estrangement, 30 years of trading insults, trading threats, name calling, occasionally violence, has been 30 years of futility. It hasn't benefited either side. The relationship has not gotten any better. The Islamic Republic is still there, and it still comes back to haunt successive administrations. I mean, I suppose a lot of American administrations would have liked Iran to go away, but it isn't. I mean, Iran brought down one president, brought down President Carter. It almost brought down President Reagan. President Bush the first, had to run away from the whole issue after the release of the hostages from Beirut in 91. So my whole view of this is, I think we can do something better. Because we do have things to talk about. Whether we like their leaders or not, whether we like their system or not, frankly, is irrelevant. Because we do have things to talk about, such as Afghanistan, such as Iraq, such as a nuclear program, such as terrorism, such as counter-narcotics. Iran, I think, has one of the largest addiction problems in the world, I am told, or so I am told. We have things to talk about, such as the three hikers. I mean, if our relationship was anything close to a normal relationship. And I'm not talking about liking each other or being friends, but just being able to speak directly to each other. I think these hikers would have been out long ago. They would have paid a fine for illegal entry into the country, and they would have been gone. But under current conditions, with all the suspicions and with all the hostility, these hikers become victims. Others become victims. I don't know if my Iranian-American friends, and if some of them may be here in the room, when their family members try to come to the United States, try to visit the United States and try to get visas, they have to go through, it's the labor of Hercules to get a visa. It takes a long time, it's expensive, it's humiliating. It's these ordinary people, like the hikers, like the travelers, who become the victims. So I would like to see at least some steps to making this situation better. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be slow. And as I go back to this other thing, when it seems you're making progress, when you seem you're getting somewhere, you're going to hit a wall. Let me end by talking about how I might see the role here. Because let me get back to the ghosts. I subtitled my book Wrestling the Ghosts of History, because I think that when we and the Iranians are dealing with each other, there are ghosts in the room. And they're very powerful ghosts. There is the ghost of Mossadegh, toppled by a CIA coup in 53. There are the ghosts of the Shah. There are the ghosts of the Status of Forces Agreement in 64. There are the ghosts of even the Treaty of Turkmenchai going back to 1828. All these things are in the room, and they're powerful. And somehow or way or another, we have to deal with them. And maybe my role and the role of some of my colleagues is to do what they did. Remember this movie, The Ghostbusters? Bill Murray and Dan Aykroyd. They had this machine that kind of was like a vacuum cleaner. And, you know, they didn't destroy the ghosts, but they somehow got the ghost into the can and put it in its proper place. And maybe at the end of the day, that's how we're going to have to do it, because we're going to have to deal with them. If you don't deal with them, they're not going away, and they'll still be there, and they'll still be powerful. Okay, thank you very much.
Unfortunately, we are now out of time. On behalf of the World Affairs Council and Books, Inc., I'd like to thank Ambassador John Limbert for providing us with his thoughts and insights, and also to wish you every success in your new assignment with the Department of State. Ambassador Limbert has agreed to stay on for a little while and sign copies of his book, and I'd encourage you to take advantage of this opportunity. The meeting's adjourned, and thank you and good night.
I'm a good friend of Bob Andrews.
Oh, yeah.